Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska!
Ladies and gentlemen, take my advice. Pull down your pants and slide on the ice.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, Feb 9, 2022, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Seska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hello. Day 386 of the Biden-Harris administration, 272 days until the 22 midterms. Find me on Instagram at TheBobSeska and on Twitter at BobSeska_go. As soon as I read Michael Hiltzik's new piece in the LA Times, I knew I had to talk with him on this show. And that's exactly what we're doing today. His op-ed is titled, "These Pundits and Polls Say They're Done with COVID, But COVID's Not Done with Us." And it pushes back against Bill Maher, Barry Weiss, and others who are demanding that Joe Biden declare an end to the pandemic before it's actually over, right? You know by now that it's driving me bananas, how utterly irresponsible and counterfactual it is. It also feels like a political trap to me. We'll get into that with Michael here in a second. By the way, Michael's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of 7 books, links in the description for everything. Meantime, if you like what you hear today, think about signing up for our bonus content at BobSeskaShow.com. All right, here's me and Michael Hiltzik talking about the make-believe-it's-over strategy.
Bob Seska.
Well, hey, thanks for coming on today, especially under short notice. I'm so glad you wrote this piece for a couple of reasons. One, I feel like I've taken crazy pills, Michael. And two, because the make-believe-it's-over thing seems to be gaining momentum, at least in the press. Here's what I can't figure out. Are people like Bill Maher misunderstanding the nuances of a pandemic? Or are they just being indulgent and delusional? I can't figure that. It's driving me nuts. Maybe you can shed some light on that.
Yeah. I think if you go back and look at what he's been saying for some time, really, I think he's basically talking his own book or taking his own, drinking his own Kool-Aid. He's basically searching for justification for taking attack that he's been taking, I think, for some time. I'm no expert in Bill Maherism, but my impression is he's been skeptical of COVID going back a ways. So.
Yeah, I noticed him starting this back in the fall. In fact, I think he started this right before the Omicron surge. And then he went on his hiatus for the Christmas break, came back, and he never said a damn thing about it once he got back from hiatus, once he started up his show again. Oh, you know what? I was premature back in the fall. Sorry. My apologies. Nothing along those lines. And so it seems like he's, as you said, he blurted out that take on his show back in, I think it was October or November, and he's really married to that take, isn't he?
Yeah, and I think it's part of his desire to be a contrarian truth teller, or is, you know, we used to say he wants to be the guy who tells it like it is. And the problem he's got is that is a lack of information. Tells it like it is based on, ignorance, essentially.
Yeah. And to be clear, it's not just Bill Maher. I mean, I've been arguing on Twitter with, Tom Nichols and some other people, Bari Weiss. I think that's how you pronounce her name. She was on with Bill Maher talking about it this year. And you, in the piece, you accused Bill Maher of both cherry picking and dealing in disinformation. Talk about some of the examples of each, where there's cherry picking going on, there's disinformation being spread. I think the masking in schools and teen suicide stat was a big one, right?
Yeah, well, let's focus on the teen suicide statistic, because that's one that we're seeing very, very commonly.
Mm-hmm.
And Weiss, in her latest appearance on Maher that I wrote about, essentially dragged out this statistic that holds that suicides among teen girls has just spiked by more than 50% when schools started to be closed. And there have been a lot of basically studies debunking that. Number one, the fact is that when this spike that was cited by the CDC first emerged, it was clear that at that point, schools were actually beginning to reopen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's clear that the so-called spike in suicides was not associated with school closings. Number two, the figure is an artifact of the reduction in suicide rates in the previous months or year when schools were closed. And that's telling, because experts in suicide have been fairly unanimous in finding that teen suicides tend to decline when school is out. They decline during summer vacations. They decline during holiday hiatuses. And they go back up when schools reopen, because at that point, I mean, I don't know all the reasons, and experts say, look, you know, suicide rates are very, very complicated to determine the causes, because suicide is a complicated phenomenon. But you're bringing students back together, you know, all the social pressures that are associated with life in school are coming back out. So this idea that the pandemic closure has somehow created a spike in teen girl suicides is just wrong.
Yeah.
Or at least it's just not accepted by qualified experts.
Are there any metrics gauging how children actually think about wearing masks in school? Because it seems like if you listen to the adults, certainly the parents of some of these kids, you'd think we were sticking them in Iron Maidens and ripping their toenails out or something like that on a regular basis. Corporal punishment, I don't know what, but it seems like this is being exaggerated to the point, oh my God, why are you torturing our children? And I'm not actually hearing that from the children. And maybe that's because there aren't a lot of studies along those lines. I don't know what it can be. But I don't get the sense that kids are going, oh, God, get these masks off of us. At long last, we want to be free. We want people to see the lower halves of our faces. Is that going on at all?
Well, I haven't seen any metrics along the lines that you described. But certainly, look, I think a lot of this is projection by parents and their ideologically inclined parents who are against masks, and they trot out these notions and they try to invest them with some sort of factual stability.
Yeah.
That masks must be bad. And there's no evidence, certainly, that physically speaking, masks are bad for kids. And children are pretty resilient. You know, they put up with a lot of discomfort. And it doesn't bother them as much as the parents, as it bothers the parents, or the parents think it should bother them.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't see any evidence. I've never seen any evidence suggesting that children are tormented by the need to wear masks. And you know, the consistency with which they don masks and keep them on is is not very strong anyway. So, you know, it's not really an issue.
Yeah, yeah, that's a whole other thing. That's like people going 10 miles an hour over the speed limit. It's going to happen, but you still have to have the speed limit in place for the purposes of safety and so on. Another thing you tackled in your piece, Michael, is, and this kind of loops in both cherry picking and disinformation, Bill Maher on a show also claimed that protocols don't work. He compared West Virginia and Massachusetts, suggesting the mortality rates were basically the same in those two places, one being quote unquote fully reopened or no restrictions, West Virginia, and then Massachusetts having mask mandates, vaccine mandates, and so on. Tell us why that's wrong.
Yeah, well, this is something that I've been tracking and I've written about at least two or three times over the last year or year and a half or 2 years, mostly in relation to the difference in the record of Florida and California, because, mm-hmm. you know, you have Governor DeSantis in Florida, who always wants to position his state as heroically sensible compared to places like California, which has had, you know, early lockdowns and fairly strict lockdowns. And the points that I've made in the past are that, first of all, we are prisoners of sort of geography, that, you know, you can't look at a state as varied as Florida, much less a state as diverse as California, and say this is all one place. In Florida, where DeSantis has been hostile to social distancing and closures and lockdowns and masks and other measures, and in fact, I think the vaccination, there are places, including the major cities in Florida, like Miami, that held to much stricter rules and regulations than the rules and regulations coming out of Tallahassee. California, there's always been a real divergence between the figures we see in the Bay Area and the figures we see in Los Angeles. And that's partially an artifact of the fact that Los Angeles is an exceptionally diverse community, mm-hmm. with a wide range of socioeconomic conditions. Northern California is different. It's certainly diverse, but it tends to be much somewhat higher educated, richer, with a better sense of health, public health measures and what have you.
Yeah.
So there's that. Now, there's also the fact that I really took Maher to task on, which is that if you look at the overall record, state by state, even taking states as monoliths, then you are conflating several waves of the pandemic. And that's particularly true when you are trying to compare a region like the Northeast with other regions, because the Northeast, as we know, suffered hugely in the pandemic in the very first wave, which struck the Northeast particularly hard at a time when we had no countermeasures. We didn't know how to treat COVID. We didn't know how to treat it in the hospital. Mm-hmm. We didn't know how to treat it out in society. We didn't have vaccines. We didn't have drugs. We didn't know about practices that would moderate the impact once a patient got to the hospital, got to the ER, got to the ICU, and what have you. So all those states, Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Rhode Island, suffered really bad waves. Mm-hmm. of death in the first few months of the pandemic. And then they got their arms around the problem after about 3 or 4 months, at the time when we were seeing spikes that were spreading around the country. And now there was a different color to the wave. So yeah, so if you put all that together and you say, well, starting in, you know, February 15th of 2020 and bring it up to now, well, yeah, all these states look very much alike. Massachusetts had a total death rate for that whole period of 325 per 100,000 residents, West Virginia 326 per 100,000 residents. But yeah. What you need to look at, as I wrote is how did these states respond once they knew what these tools were to respond to this pandemic? And once, particularly after the Delta wave struck, starting in very early summer of 2021, and also after the first wave. So I looked at the figures. These came directly from the CDC for the post-July 2020 rate, which is after the first wave, and then the post-July 2021 rate, which is after the Delta, which accommodates the Delta wave. And we find that there's a huge, really striking divergence. And if you just want to look at Massachusetts and West Virginia, the Delta death rate in Massachusetts was 64 per 100,000 residents. The Delta death rate in West Virginia was 164
wow.
per 100,000 residents. And we see that across all the states, the states that were really lax: Florida, Mississippi, Arizona, Georgia, Tennessee, and compare them to California and New Jersey, which got its arms around the problem, you know, after that first wave, and Washington State. You see this huge divergence that really tells you the story that a serious approach to social measures, to vaccination, and to non-medical measures like masking and social distancing and shutdowns really did pay off for those states, for Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, California, and really left residents of Florida and West Virginia and Alabama, Georgia, Arizona, and Mississippi that copped this attitude that we weren't going to do anything against COVID. They have really suffered. I mean, Arizona in the Delta era, its death rate was 363 per 100,000. That's just huge. Mississippi, 387 per 100,000. Wow. California, 43. New Jersey, 61. So you can see that, yeah. that, you know, if Marr is trying to say that nothing works, he's absolutely dead wrong.
Yeah.
And he should know this. So it's disinformation, not just misinformation.
And, you know, speaking of disinformation, there's something that is brutally disingenuous to me, and it's happening right now. There was a piece in The Atlantic today. It's a weird semantic thing going on, Michael. In that Atlantic piece today, the headline was "Open Everything." Is there anything that's not open? I mean, everything's open now, but mask and vaccine mandates continue, obviously, as they should, depending on spikes, depending on regional outbreaks. It seems like the insane blunder is lying to people and telling them it's over, period, full stop, when it's clearly not. It hasn't receded to becoming livable yet. But why have they chosen to go with this, let's reopen, let's open everything, as if it's still April of 2020 and we're all under lockdown in our homes? What is the objective with framing it like that?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, these are people who are living in the dream world. You know, they see that at the moment, the Omicron wave is ebbing, and it's ebbing, you know, fairly sharpish at this point. And they're thinking ahead that, well, you know, that's the last wave we're going to live through. And after Omicron is gone, we're going to have sort of this low level endemic problem with COVID, akin to what we have with the flu and, you know, seasonal infections. So we might as well, you know, essentially give up now. Now, you know, several reasons for unease or disquiet about that. One is that we don't know that there isn't going to be another wave. And the more we are leaving ourselves undefended against this virus, the worse that next wave may very well be. And number two, it's not over. Even if you're looking at the curve, which is coming down, it's not over. If you're an ICU healthcare worker or an ER worker, you are still feeling the pressure. You're still seeing people coming in the doors every day. We're still seeing 10,000 deaths per week from COVID. You know, a lot of our medical institutions are overwhelmed, and that's after, you know, they've been suffering from burnout for years. We have, you know, still, I think, you know, a shamefully low vaccination rate in general, and definitely in some places, especially the places that have been early in this, let's get back to normal now. So the threat is still very real. And although we can, as I quoted Claudia Sahm, who is an excellent economist and a consultant, former Federal Reserve economist, who's been very outspoken about this. And she said, look, it's not unreasonable to start thinking about what indications we should look at to determine how to go back to normal or how to reopen. And maybe it's not unreasonable to start reopening some things, but we're not there yet, really. We still have to deal with this, and we're putting ourselves at great risk. And I think what's happening is that politicians, including Democratic politicians, in my state, Governor Newsom is basically moving to reopen a lot of rules or to lift a lot of rules that were statewide. They're responding to this overall fatigue that we all feel that, you know, every 2 years, are we still doing this? But you're right. You know, in many ways, we're not still doing it. You know, Barry Weiss, you know, in a sort of infantile outburst that she engaged in on the Maher show, talked about how, I did everything. I sprayed my Pringles can with, you know, with disinfectant. I didn't go out, as if, you know, she really sacrificed herself by, spraying her groceries. and I'm tired of that. I'm not going to do it anymore, you know. And she was sort of smug, not only saying she was done with it, but she was suggesting that we all should be done with it because, she's basically sitting in traffic and looking at the cars around her and not really about the big picture that not everybody lives up her street, you know, that there are a lot of communities where this is still a raging problem. There are a lot of communities where, you know, if somebody in the household get sick and they have to stay home, they're not going to get paid, you know, and they may not be able to make the rent or put food on the table because the safety net we created over the last 2 years is basically now over, at least at the federal level. I mean, California, we've reinstituted sick pay in the state, but it's not true at the federal level. So a lot of this is, you know, elite commentators. Yasha Monk, who wrote that piece in The Atlantic that you referred to, is a professor at Johns Hopkins.
Yeah.
He can work from home. You know, he can hold a class over Zoom. Uh-huh. You know, he doesn't have to go out there and flip burgers and meet, you know, face to face with customers over a counter every day and if he doesn't do that, not get paid. He can stay home and he gets paid, to him, all of this stuff is superfluous. That's simply not true of everybody. And I should say, by the way, that I actually took Monk to task by email just earlier today because he made a reference to a column that I wrote a few weeks ago, and he got the column 100% wrong. And I said, look, you know, I suppose I should be grateful that you mentioned it at all, but you described it in 9 words and you didn't really get my argument. Mm-hmm. So either describe it in more than 9 words or don't mention it, you know, or at least read the column with some care. Anyway, but that's an aside, you know. But his whole piece was sort of this, you know, everything looks fine to me. So why should anybody really have to go through this?
Okay, short break, back with more show right after these words.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. You'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
The Bob Seska Show.
Maybe I'm being paranoid about this, Michael, but it seems like maybe there's an agenda with the notion of quote unquote open everything, which indicates there are things that are still closed, which then indicates that Democratic leadership is responsible for keeping those things closed, and we're pushing back against Democratic leadership. That not only has the effect of convincing regular American voters that it's the Democrats who are the problem here, but then it also kind of coerces those Democratic leaders to, you know, play along with this, let's drop everything, let's stop the protocols and declare the pandemic magically over. It just seems like a trap to me. There's another aspect to the trap. Frank Luntz is quoted in the Atlantic piece suggesting Biden should use his State of the Union address to announce, and he actually uses the word, enough. Like Biden should get up on the dais in front of the joint session and say, enough, it's over, and end the pandemic somehow. But if there's another variant spike, how bad will that be for the Democrats ahead of the midterms? They should count on Republicans probably flipping the script at that point and saying, hey, I thought senile cognitive issues, old Joe Biden said it was over. I guess he was sundowning or so. There's going to be something where they say, where they blame Joe Biden or they blame Democratic governors for reopening too soon, in their own words, right? It just seems like they're being painted into a corner.
I think this sort of plays into, you know, something that I've written about regarding the Democrats for years now, and that is that the problem that the Democratic Party has in general is that they are really afraid that their voters are stupid, and that, so stupid that they are vulnerable to the sound bites that come from the right and from the Republicans. So they basically are shy about it, sort of messaging communicating what their message should be. And I have some sympathy for that, because if you're trying to communicate a Democratic policy, it's nuanced by its nature, and it's very hard to communicate nuance in words of one syllable.
Yeah.
Whereas Republicans who just want to say no and you know, wrong, it's much easier. And I think that a lot of what we're seeing in blue states right now, including California, is this fear coming around, which, as you said, the Democrats are afraid that they're going to be blamed for keeping the economy closed, even though the economy has been thriving. And they don't realize that if they get it wrong, they are going to be blamed by the Republicans. So I think they are in a bit of a box. You know, one of the things that I find very interesting about this whole phenomenon is that, and once again, I'm drawing a line from California because that's, you know, that's the traffic jam that I'm in. Is that, you know, at the state level, Gavin Newsom, the governor, and state authorities are basically saying, yeah, okay, you can, you know, we can lift this restriction and that restriction. We can get back to normal at certain levels, although, you know, there's still holding back on schools, but in a lot of individual communities like the County of Los Angeles and San Francisco City and County, they're saying, we're not ready to do that yet. So, okay, you know, you want to do it at the state level, but we're not making changes quite yet for our residents and our voters in our communities.
Yeah.
We're going to wait and see how things develop, because they have a much better sense of what's happening on the ground. And I think that's also true. This is what we saw in Florida, you know, where the authorities in Miami said, no, we're not, you know, we're not throwing everything open the way DeSantis wants. We're going to take a more nuanced and judicious approach.
Right. Yeah. And the other canard along those lines right now is that Americans support ending all protocols, when that isn't actually true. Nate Cohn wrote a piece the other day where he was kind of suggesting that, like, oh, Americans think it's time to start phasing out this ridiculous pandemic thing that should be over. But polling actually shows otherwise. And he even cited the YouGov poll that kind of, if you look at the crosstabs and you look at the additional numbers, disproves what he was saying. 60% are worried about COVID. 69% don't think the pandemic is over. 82% want to wear a mask at least some of the time. A majority think we need to vaccinate and wear masks and test. So it's not like there's a very real pushback against these protocols. There's nothing along those lines, at least with if you believe the polls. And you could make an argument that the polls have been way off for years or whatever else. This is what we're looking at in terms of popular sentiment at this point. There is no majority demand for the end of protocols, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, I got out of the business of trusting polls, you know, on November 8th, 2016.
Yeah, me too.
But you know, I even if you're inclined to say, well, this, you know, this pollster is reliable, everybody knows that poll results are very, very sensitive to how you put the question. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's this whole question of how you interpret it. And think about Cohn. I mean, I didn't actually read his. I don't think I looked at his article. If he wrote an article about the poll. But I did sort of follow the Twitter commentary on it. And I think he said, well, 46% in this poll of respondents are in favor of lifting restrictions, and only 43% are against lifting or in favor of keeping the restrictions on. And of course, there's a lot of commentary saying, well, you know, 46% and 43%, if one is only, the other is only, you know, and it's basically an even split. I think if you really honestly ask people what they think, they're not entirely comfortable with just throwing all the doors open completely. Mm-hmm. You know, around here where I am, there is, you know, fairly good mask compliance. I had to spend a week in Florida a couple of weeks ago, and mask compliance there was 0%.
Yeah,
but things are different depending, you know, where you stand and where you sit and where you live. But overall, I think, you know, if you really put the whole country together, there's not this huge groundswell of people saying, "Yeah, take all the restrictions off." Though I think people tend to be relieved when the restrictions come off, in part because they take that as a signal that things are all better now. And they could be very unhappily surprised if it turns out that things are not better. And, you know, we felt before Delta that we were getting back to normal and that we were even approaching herd immunity. And then Delta told us, I have something to say about that. No, and yeah. Omicron had a different, thing to say on its own. So, I think Democratic politicians are sort of trying to feed a sense of normality, and they're crossing their fingers that it doesn't come back and bite them. Because, look, once you take all these restrictions off, reinstilling them, if they have to be done, is going to be, I think, really impossible.
I've been saying on my show that it's kind of like once you've graduated from school and then suddenly a few years later, you have to go back and take a class again. Reigniting that engine is a lot more difficult. Finding the motivation to do it is a lot more difficult than if you just continue doing it. It's like someone who graduates from high school and then takes 2 years off to travel Europe. Oh, then I'll just go to college after that. Well, they discover, oh my God, do I really want to sit in a classroom after all of this experience in the real world? And to do that, to rewire your brain back into that, is a lot more difficult than it seems. And it's got to be the same way with protocols. There was a British MP today who announced that they were ending all protocols and that it was basically, he was saying, it was over for good. And I wanted to say, don't say for good. You know, there might be another big variant spike. We don't know. There's a big question mark here. Could be over shortly, might not be over shortly. We don't know yet. It's too early. And then to have to, as you were saying, re-implement all those protocols is just going to be an uphill climb. It's just not going to happen, is it?
Yeah, I think the best you can say, without fear of being contradicted, is that it's probably premature.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it does make sense to think about, you know, what would be the indicators that we really are on the way to normality? I mean, mm-hmm. we can talk about, the rate of intake at hospitals. We can talk about ICU capacity, things like that. We can talk about what we're seeing in wastewater and all this stuff and positivity rates among tests and those things. But, you know, we're doing all this without even considering what, you know, what the indicators are. And yeah. I think that's that makes me nervous.
Someone on Twitter today said it's like chucking your antibiotics as soon as you feel a little better instead of finishing the prescription as it's instructed, right?
Yeah, that's a very good comparison. Yeah, absolutely.
I've always felt mortality shouldn't be the sole metric. I think we were talking about this earlier about the death rate. And I believe that shouldn't be the sole metric for determining COVID protocol. Bill Maher has cited that as a thing, certainly with school kids. Well, there's only 800 kids that have died from COVID. Well, there are many damaging things that can occur to a person or a community for that matter, short of dying. And, you know, one of the metrics we often overlook is hospital capacity, which today stands at 78%. I think it's technically 77.89%, something along those lines. I haven't seen any stats showing the number of people who've died from non-COVID illnesses and injuries due to overcrowded ICUs. But I've noticed, however, data indicating that exceeding the 75% capacity number leads to tens of thousands of what they're calling extra deaths. Maher and the others don't even address that, do they? Because that's something that's down the line. That's other people, right?
I think you make a couple of very good points there. Number one is, you're right, mortality is not the only metric. You know, COVID, we've known from the very beginning, has a lot of health consequences that are short of mortality or that may shorten your life, but you won't know that for another 20 years. But, you know, we have long COVID, which we still really don't have a grasp of. We have, you know, COVID has a way, the virus has a way of attacking systems in your body that have other consequences. And even if you're looking at the death rates themselves, you know, you're not even thinking about, you know, what are the, even if you want to accept that there are consequences to keeping children out of school for a year and trying remote learning, what are the consequences? You know, we have 850,000, 900,000 deaths. That's hundreds of thousands of children who are growing up without one parent, maybe two parents, without grandparents, without brothers and sisters. What's the impact, the psychological impact, and maybe the financial impact on them? So there are a lot of consequences of this pandemic that we're not really accounting for that are going to be with us for really a generation, maybe longer. And we're not talking about that at all. And Maher, you know, Maher questioned the death figures anyway, and he was wrong to do that, because if anything, I think the experts say, you know, 900,000 deaths, that may be an underestimate.
Yeah.
It's not an overestimate.
And have we just become immune, emotionally immune to mass death? It seems like we have. Seems like if you go back to a previous example of mass death in this country, you have to talk about 9/11 and how shocking that was. Thousands of people being killed in this very visually dramatic way. And we now have another situation that's also, in a sense, visually dramatic, because we're seeing people suffocating to death by the hundreds of thousands in hospitals across the country. And that's visually shocking to see. But we're talking about 900,000 versus 9/11 was 3,000. And we've just stopped really kind of acknowledging the horror of that. And I find that to be really disturbing and potentially damaging for the soul of America, not necessarily in a spiritual sense, but just in terms of how we empathize with our fellow Americans. Seems like that's flown out the window.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, there's a saying, maybe a joke. It's a gruesome joke mm-hmm. in the news business, which you're probably, you know, familiar with, that, you know, 10,000 people, you know, perishing in a, you know, in an earthquake. Well, that's, you know, that's a news story. One person dying, that's human interest story. And that gets a lot more attention. And this, you know, I think it probably dates back to the Stalinist days when, you know, millions of people perished, or even the Holocaust. And as I pointed out in the column I wrote most recently, the daily average of new deaths this month alone, you know, 3,164 is more than the total number of deaths that were recorded in the 9/11 attacks.
Jesus.
So that's, you know, more than one 9/11 per day in the month of February. And we are, I think, sort of inured to this. Someone pointed out that, you know, a year, I can't remember even how long ago it was, but when the country crossed 100,000 deaths from COVID, the New York Times, you know, ran a huge front page screamer headline with, you know, all text, you know, with the names of, you know, a couple of hundred of the deaths. And the headline was, you know, 100,000 deaths, an incalculable loss. Well, now we have 900,000 deaths.
Yep.
And, you know, we seem to be sort of coasting through that. Maybe when we hit a million, people will wake up again, because a million is a number that, you know, that has a certain amount of meaning to people, and it's got a certain amount of color. But yeah, 900,000 deaths. And we know that, we know that's where we are. And yeah, we've sort of become used to it. And even 900,000 deaths, you know, that means that the vast majority of Americans don't have anybody close to them who's died of COVID. I mean, I've got, you know, maybe a half a dozen acquaintances who've been infected and survived, including my two adult children who, you know, decided to play with fire and, you know, and subjected themselves to, you know, situations where they were likely to catch it, but they're young, you know, they were fully boosted and fully vaccinated and, you know, little devil may care. But I don't know, as far as I know, or can remember, I don't know anyone who's died, at least no one personally. And I think most people are in that situation. Yep. It's, on the other hand, there are families that have lost, you know, both parents and maybe a child, maybe more than one child. And to them, this is an incalculable loss, you know. Households that relied on, on generations living together, who've now been hollowed out. So to them, this is not over. You know, they're not over COVID. Yeah. They're just beginning to deal with the consequence.
Is this going to metastasize, Michael? Is this a view? And we've been focusing on Bill Maher a lot, but there are quite a few others, you know, maybe a dozen others who are columnists, influencers, if you want to call them that, people who have the attention of a large audience. Is this going to really become a thing, or is this going to kind of recede or get overtaken by some other news cycle? Or is this just going to be, has this horse left the gate and we're just kind of going to have to deal with basically an uncontrolled pandemic from this point forward?
Well, the degree to which the misinformation and disinformation has taken hold of American society is stunning to me. And, you know, I've covered a lot of topics, you know, where I've constantly had to fight sort of received wisdom, you know, that's wrong. I mean, I write a lot about Social Security and Medicare, and I've written a lot about Obamacare, where dealing with the inaccuracies of even reporting from mainstream reliable publications, much less these, you know, big audience fringe characters, has been, I've often compared it to the tortures of Sisyphus, you know, who had to roll a boulder up the mountain, and every time he got to the top, you know, it rolled back down again. And you spend time sort of assembling your facts and marching them all across the page and debunking, just stupid notions, and then they crop up again. And I think that's what I saw with Maher and Weiss. And of course, what we've seen with Joe Rogan, you know, just impervious to the stupidity of what he's putting out, what any of them are putting out on the air. So it sort of depends on what the overall situation is going to be. I mean, if we COVID does enter an endemic phase and we have outbreaks here and there, but on the whole, you know, we are dealing with it, then I think, you know, this we'll be able to look back at this in the rearview mirror and say, that was a dark time, but, you know, we're back.
Yeah.
Maybe. if we continue to have, you know, serious problems. But even in that case, you know, we are, I think, for years now, going to be dealing with the consequences, the lasting consequences of the pandemic, of the acute stages of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. We're going to be dealing with long-term health problems. We're going to be dealing with psychological problems from households that have been hollowed out. We're going to be dealing with the costs that society is going to have to deal with. I mean, you know, there's going to be a spike, I think, in disability claims. Who's going to pay for healthcare of people who, you know, who are still uninsured or underinsured? Mm-hmm. Well, how is society going to deal with that? We're going to have to deal with all of that. And we're going to be able to look back and say, we're still, the consequences are not going away anytime soon. And, you know, probably our children will maybe have, be able to look at this as sort of an artifact of an earlier time, the way we look at life during the Second World War, you know, or during the Depression. I mean, my grandparents or, you know, even great grandparents, you know, had ways of dealing with their household finances that really are artifacts of the Depression. You know, they wouldn't throw anything away. They wouldn't spend money. You know, they just husbanded their resources for the rest of their lives. And I think we're going to still see some of that. But I think that the fixation we have on documenting every death and every illness and watching infection rates, that's going to go away as it becomes less and less important. But that's just, you know, one level of consequences. We're going to be living with this for a long time.
Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Michael Hiltzik, the LA Times article is titled, "These pundits and polls say they're done with COVID, but COVID's not done with us." It is a must read. Go there now and check it out. Link in the description under this episode at bobsesca.com. His seventh book, Iron Empires, Robber Barons, Railroads, and the Making of a Modern America, is out right now. Link for that, too, in the description. Thank you so much, Michael, for what you're doing, especially this piece. I feel a lot less alone pushing it back against all of this crap. And it's been such a pleasure to talk to you today.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.